Good morning and welcome to A Public Affair on KGNU. I am your host, Tish Buford, and happy holidays to all of you wonderful men, women, and hopefully very well-behaved and very good little boys and girls. You guys know Santa's coming, and you know that we're getting ready to enter a new year. And 2020 has been extremely difficult and hard for a lot of people under these extraordinarily very unforeseen circumstances. And to that end, we have a lot of men and women and families that are suffering from home issues, being displaced from their homes, not being employed, being food deprived, home deprived. And at this time of year, and it's relevant every day of the year, that we focus on our displaced brothers and sisters and children who are without food and without home and shelter, especially in the winter months and especially during the holidays. And to discuss that in a lot more detail and discuss what is going on with this wonderful institution here in Denver, Colorado, we have Nicole Cheddar from Denver Rescue Mission to discuss what's going on currently with the shelter and how they're serving the community and those and for those of our brothers and sisters and children who are now being affected by not only the winter months, but also that the pandemic has impacted millions of people. Good morning, Nicole. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on to talk a little bit more about what we're doing at Denver Rescue Mission. I'm looking forward to sharing a little bit more of that with you and for everyone listening this morning.
Absolutely. Now, I did take the liberty of providing a bit of a longer introduction because it goes without saying that we need to always emphasize on those who are struggling or who are less fortunate. But given the extraordinary circumstances, as I just alluded to and briefly touched on, we want to discuss how this has impacted the Denver Rescue Mission's normal efforts and what steps you guys are taking to accommodate that, especially in this time of a worldwide pandemic that's already taken, unfortunately, 318,000 lives and infected over 18 million people in our country alone. So locally in Denver, what do your numbers normally look like in the normal winter months that usually start in late October and go through January?
At Denver Rescue Mission, we tend to see higher numbers through the winter months. It's hard to compare our numbers to last year because our operations are so different. We are not operating out of our Lawrence Street shelter currently because we needed to operate at the Denver Coliseum and the 48th Avenue Center to be able to socially distance our guests and to provide them with a safe and healthy environment during the pandemic. But with that said, looking at our numbers, we are definitely seeing more people. As I mentioned, we are operating those two 24/7 shelters, but then we're also still operating our Lawrence Street Community Center for meals only. And we're seeing about 900 meals just at that one shelter, as well as the 300 at the Denver Coliseum, and then just below 300 at the 48th Avenue Center. And we've even opened up an emergency overnight shelter, which can house up to 200 men. And that one had 188 men last night. And so we are seeing higher numbers. You know, it's hard to say if that's directly from the pandemic, just because we haven't seen the ramifications of evictions and all of that stuff yet. But we can pretty safely say that, you know, it is, you know, a result of what has been happening this past year.
Absolutely. Now, I was trying to do the math in my head as you were speaking. So it sounds like it's about 2,000 people a day that you guys are serving on average right now. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, so I would say it's a little bit below 2,000, but, you know, between all of our different shelters, and that doesn't even include our transitional facilities. This is just emergency shelters specifically, but it is over 1,000 people, which you know, I think we lump that into one big number, but you start thinking of that as one individual person and, you know, think of their story and where they're at. And so kind of just trying to see each of those as a different human being and understanding their story one at a time. Right. Those numbers start to get overwhelming. And so we try to, you know, just meet each person at their point of need.
Absolutely. Now, you touched on people that are in transition or families that are transition. Can you explain to our listeners what that entails and what those families and individuals are normally going through when they have to rely on your services?
So at Denver Rescue Mission, we have two transitional programs. One is our STAR transitional program, and the other is our New Life program. The New Life program focuses specifically on men who are trying to overcome destructive habits. This program currently is pretty full. We have capacity for 100 men safely to be in this program. And then our STAR program is for families and individuals and seniors who just need a little bit of help right now. And so this isn't necessarily that shelter mentality that people think of when they think of Denver Rescue Mission. These individuals live at our location, and it's called The Crossing. We help them with case management. We pair them with mentors. We really help them to understand financial literacy and just help them get their, you know, feet back on the ground. And I will say with COVID-19, we're seeing more and more people fall into this category of not necessarily that stereotypical homeless, you know, perception that we have in our mind, but more so, you know, families and hardworking people who, you know, maybe were working in the restaurant industry or, you know, had just lost their job and just need a little bit more support right now to make ends meet.
And I'm glad you made that distinction, because when people hear Denver Rescue Mission, they automatically think homeless, and which is why I wanted to discuss the different variants of services you do provide, because it's not just for our displaced brothers and sisters and children, but it's just for people that may be going through, like you said, coming out of destructive behavior, who may be in between jobs, who needs a bridge to maybe get to the other side of their life situation and improve it. So what type of programs, other than the ones that you just described to me, that are available that you think the public may not know about?
Absolutely. So I think another one that is really crucial right now is called our Next Step Services. And this is a service that we provide to the men who are staying at our 48th Avenue Center. And this is kind of, you know, exactly like what the name entails. It's trying to figure out those next steps for these individuals, whether that is to go into one of those programs I was just talking about, or it could be something as simple as getting their identification, as such as like their license or their social security card, or finding a job that pays better. We're finding more and more of the individuals that we serve have jobs, but it's just not meeting that need for them to make ends meet to live, you know, in Denver or the surrounding areas. And so this service really meets, you know, these individuals at their point of need, whether that be, you know, I need, you know, something more substantial and to go into one of these programs, or I just need help getting my driver's license and figuring out those steps. And so I think that that's a service that not a lot of people know about. We also have our Family Rescue Ministries, and this is for, you know, families who just need a little bit more help and they don't necessarily need to stay at The Crossing. But this program helps them get their first month's rent, their deposit, and pairs them up with a living situation that they can afford, as well as with a mentor or a mentor group out in the community to kind of guide them through that. And so I think that that's another program that a lot of people don't know about that Denver Rescue Mission does. And then the final one is our Family Refugee Services, which is very similar to our Family Rescue Ministries. And that is just to help refugee families get on their feet and find a permanent housing situation.
That's wonderful. All these programs sound extraordinary. And do you think there is a particular reason, and this is no reflection on the River Rescue mission, but do you think there's a particular reason that these programs are not well known? And I'm sure people, a lot of people in the community take advantage of them, but you don't hear these programs being discussed a lot on a regular basis in the community. Why do you think there is such a disparity in messaging between the normal homeless services you guys provide and versus the auxiliary programs that you just described? Why do you think that's not more well known?
I think the biggest reason that some of these programs aren't as well known, I think the first is that Denver Rescue Mission has just, you know, been known as that staple emergency shelter for the past 128 years. And so yes. I know, I even know when I, you know, started with the mission 3 years ago, I was like, oh, emergency services with overnight sheltering and food. And then you start digging in and you know that a little bit more. I also think, you know, it's that education piece and, you know, the community kind of seeing past the stereotypical idea of what it is to be homeless. And a lot of people, you know, don't always take that next step to realize, you know, it is these families. It is, you know, it could be your neighbor, an old baseball coach. It could be someone in your family who's struggling with homelessness. And so I don't think people always take that next step to understand that homelessness goes so much further than just someone, you know, that stereotypical vision of someone standing on the street corner begging for money. It goes so much further than that, and it's so much more complex than that. And, you know, even in the past year, in the past couple of months, the idea of homelessness has just changed so much. And so I just always encourage, you know, people in the community, they ask, you know, what can I do to understand, you know, this topic and what you guys do more? And I think the first and the easiest step is to just learn more and be curious about all the different homeless providers here in Denver, not just Denver Rescue Mission, and especially just, you know, kind of breaking apart those preconceived notions and getting to know these individuals that we serve, because they're just like you and I.
Well, absolutely. And Nicole, thank you for that wonderful insight and explanation to these wonderful programs that you provide. And I'm glad you touched on it. Part of the reason that I wanted you here today was not only for awareness of the issues going on with people that are truly displaced and homeless, but also people that are going through transition or who have specific issues that need assistance that people may not be aware of that they can get assistance through with the Denver Rescue Mission. So I want to not only heighten awareness to the, you know, the more popular problem, unfortunately, which is homelessness and displacement, but also other subcategories of issues that people struggle with, who are working but cannot make a living wage, people who want to be, you know, get an ID or get a PO box or just get normal administrative things done in their lives, and they need guidance or help with that, or people who do want to live healthy and normal lives who are struggling with addiction or psychological issues. And these are the things that people don't know that you guys do. So not only do we want to touch on, again, the homelessness piece of it, which gets a lot of airtime, but I want to educate people this morning about so many other resources that are out there. So if someone is listening who wants to help get involved or help someone who needs help or get help themselves, this is just a wonderful, wonderful conversation that needed to happen today. And I'm so glad you're here to educate all of us. Now, if you guys have these many different categories of people that need to come in and be helped, what type of criteria do you have? Or do you just have people that come in, you know, without an appointment and just show up first come, first serve, and you help them and then identify their needs as they come in to the center and to the shelter?
Yeah, so Denver Rescue Mission, we, you know, I have to give kudos to our frontline staff because they are just the most incredible human beings who continually just dive in the fire, especially with COVID-19. They didn't, you know, have the luxury to stay at home and self-isolate and all of that. You know, they are on the front lines really meeting these individuals. And so, you know, there are different tiers. And so, you know, if somebody is out there and struggling and they want help, they can go straight into our Lawrence Street Community Center and meet with one of our staff members. They can get a meal. They can figure out sheltering for the night. And then if they want further help, they can meet with one of our case managers on site. And those individuals, you know, will identify, you know, is this person's need something that Denver Rescue Mission can help them with? Or is it something that Volunteers of America or Catholic Charities? We have a great, you know, working partnerships with all the different homeless providers here in Denver. And so, you know, if they need something that, you know, is more catered towards, you know, something that Volunteers of America specializes in, we work with them and make sure that, you know, they really get the help that they need. So anyone can walk in and, you know, go to the Lawrence Street Community Center and get help.
Oh, absolutely. And I didn't mean to cut you off there.
You're totally fine. You're just so excited.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I'm excited to hear, and I knew this already, but the community may not know just how quickly all of these intra-community organizations work together and how vital it is for you guys to keep your lines of communication open to help serve the overlapping needs of our community. So it is just fantastic to hear how closely you guys are working together, because I know it is very necessary to do that, because if you guys operated in silos apart from each other within the same city or the same state, you guys would not be nearly as effective, I'm sure, right?
Oh, I agree 1,000%, especially this past year with COVID. It has really been remarkable to see what we can accomplish when we work together. I mean, the city of Denver, as well as all those other homeless service providers that I've been talking about. I mean, we have really worked together to make sure that we are putting the health and the safety of the most vulnerable in our community as a, you know, as a top priority. So it's been really, really awesome to see all of us just work together to make sure that we're looking out for those in need. Denver Rescue Mission is a huge proponent of teaching financial literacy and helping individuals not just get jobs. You know, I talked about our Next Step services and some of those transitional programs, but we really work with these individuals to find them jobs that, you know, won't just help them get by, but to really, you know, be self-sufficient and to thrive and to, you know, be able to live comfortably. And so right. We really, really work hard to, you know, try to get these individuals into a job that is able to support them, you know, and to be able to provide them a life to live here in Denver. I will say, you know, you walk into one of our shelters right now, and I think a lot of people would be surprised to see, you know, the number of men who are in khakis and a button-up shirt and who are going to work and who are so hardworking, but they're staying at our shelter and they have these jobs. And I think, you know, you talked a little bit about it. It is just so expensive to live here right now that even people who are making a pretty, you know, decent wage, they just can't afford to pay rent and utilities and insurance and all of that. And they are, you know, working one or two jobs and just, you know, it is just very difficult to get their feet on the ground. And so we just really try to, you know, provide them with resources to, you know, get a better paying job or to find, you know, a better living situation that they can afford and to just really encourage them for, you know, the best resources that they need and, it's hard to say that there's, you know, a one hat fits all, you know, solution for all of this. And so we really just meet each of these individuals, you know, based off of, you know, their current struggles and their current challenges.
You know, and listening to you just go into that explanation, it just touched my heart. I mean, all of this touches my heart very deeply. And you just touched on something that was very important, that the face of homelessness or displacement doesn't look the same for everybody. And I think sometimes people kind of get their vision of what that looks like skewed. And I don't think it's intentional, but I think they just have a vision of what they think homelessness or financial struggles look like. And unfortunately, the stereotype in most cases is something where the scenario involves someone either being mentally, you know, incapacitated or having, you know, drug or dependency issues. But as you just said, there are also other men and women who are just working, who are just trying to exist. And they're dotting all their P's and dotting all their, you know, what is the saying, crossing the and dotting all their I's and everything. And they're still trying to just exist and stay on their feet and stay above water. So you guys help with both extremes, with our brothers and sisters who need more assistance, like you said, in certain programs with dependency, chemical dependency, alcoholism, mental health, but also people who do not have those unique issues, but also are just trying to stay afloat and elevate their life in a positive direction, as with our other brothers and sisters who have other challenges on top of the normal challenges that, you know, compound what they already have in front of them. So what do you tell people who ask you, how do you mentally try to help support and keep these men and women and these families engaged and motivated in your mission to try to help and sustain their lives?
I can't even, you know, begin to fathom the challenges and the trauma that these individuals have been through. It is just, you know, the most remarkable stories. And I think one of the things that Denver Rescue Mission really does well is we have case managers who specialize and who went to school to, you know, really just meet these individuals at whatever challenge that they're going through, whether that is mental illness or substance abuse or, you know, trying to figure out the next steps for their jobs. And I think that, you know, it'd be, you know, so easy to just say, you know, it's the easiest job and, you know, we meet each of these people and they're transformed, but it is a journey and it is, you know, climbing a mountain, but we, you know, we meet them and we walk alongside them. You know, we say that again and time and time again, that we really come alongside each of these individuals and help carry them through these challenges, whatever that may be. And our frontline staff does a really good job of, you know, trying to dig through, you know, some of those issues and trying to get them the support they need, whatever that may be. And, you know, I think it's, you know, just taking each day by day. And I think COVID has added another element of, you know, anxiety and challenges on top of that. But our frontline staff just does a really good job of just encouraging and supporting and just really being there for these individuals every single day.
And it sounds like they're all phenomenal men and women. And I think the thing sometimes that gets lost in situations like this, when we're discussing homelessness and other challenges that you guys serve so well, are the frontline people and the people behind the scenes that do all this extraordinary work to help our brothers and sisters get back on their feet and help them face and overcome their challenges. And I cannot emphasize and stress enough how necessary they are and without these wonderful men and women who are putting themselves in harm's way, especially right now during COVID, with this pandemic going on. But also too, this job, you know, as far as case managers, frontline workers, it takes an emotional toll on the men and women who do this job, because they are also not only extraordinary human beings, but they're also human beings. So how do the frontline workers and the case managers and other men and women who devote all their time and their heart and their dedication to the community, how do they keep themselves mentally strong and healthy? What do you guys have as far as any kind of support programs to help them cope with doing such a difficult job?
Absolutely. So we have, I will say, you know, of all the places I have, you know, worked at and been a part of, we have the most supportive leadership staff. Our CEO every single day is sending out positive and encouraging messages to our entire staff of 300 people. And he knows every single person's name. And we are constantly having, you know, community members and then also just individuals on our staff step up to, you know, provide lunches and meals.
Every little bit counts. So whether you have time, monetary things, or actual logistical things, you know, or tangible things to donate, please donate if you can, because we all have to help each other. And we got to try to make sure that we all stay as healthy and vital as possible. And we need each other to do that and to lift each other up to get to that point where we all can be safe, healthy, and prosperous. So, Nicole Cheddar, thank you again so much. You're an absolute delight. And we would love to have you back again in the future and talk to you about, you know, some of the other great things that you guys will be doing in the future.
Thank you so, so much. And I'm wishing you all a very happy holidays.
You too. And thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all for listening this morning. You've been listening to A Public Affair on KGNU Community Radio. I'm your host, Tish Buford. Happy holidays to you. Please stay safe and please stay engaged. Thank you for listening and have a safe Christmas and a happy new year.
I hope so. I started writing this book while I was pregnant with my first child, my daughter, Clara. And she was actually born on election night in 2016. And I sort of got this big boost of, you know, I was worried about what her future would be as a woman in this society. And I just felt like, you know, I had to try and record some of the thoughts that I was having about, you know, what women go through. And, you know, I had always thought about this cult, and I just dove deeper into that. And the book is really, it's for girls everywhere because they have such a difficult journey ahead of them.
So the other aspect of the book is the pandemic. Now, you said you started writing this 3-4 years ago, and there was no pandemic going on, but the book was released, I believe, this summer during the pandemic. And so tell us about the pandemic, where you got the idea, describe the pandemic, and where you got the idea for it, and then how you feel about this book now coming out in a real pandemic.
Oh, it has been the wildest ride imaginable. I did start this book 3 and 4 years ago, and I was living in Honolulu at the time. So I was thinking about cults and I had this dream, this vision of this girl crossing the desert with a young child. And I knew she was running from somewhere and running to someplace, but I didn't know any more than that. While I was pregnant, we had a Zika epidemic. And I lived in Honolulu, so it was this tropical location. We had the mosquitoes that could spread this virus that was catastrophic for pregnant women. My daughter probably still remembers the smell of DEET because I was covered in it. And I heard on the radio, you know, on NPR, they would say pregnant women stay away from standing bodies of water. And I just got this like tiny glimpse of how a public health issue could really turn life upside down. And I was terrified. I always say that I write about the things that scare me, and the things that scare me, you know, our cults and pandemics. And that was, you know, sort of the, you know, writing for me is a little bit like dreaming awake. I was working through those issues in my own life, I think, you know, what it means to be a woman, and then what it also means to be the citizen of a world that you don't control, where sort of anything can happen. And yeah, so the pandemic was just rooted in that. I certainly had no idea COVID-19 was coming. And as I was preparing for the book to release, I remember in the spring sort of watching what was going on, you know, getting calls from my publicist, getting calls from marketing, and trying to figure out, you know, how we were going to talk about this. And then it was ultimately released on June 9th, 2020, when things were really bad, not as dark as they are now, but quite bad. And I felt I was in a very strange position of looking to my own work for guidance about how to sort of survive this moment. One of the things about Agnes is she's a wonderful caregiver, and she does some pandemic parenting that we're all doing now. And I remember thinking, like, you know, when I was at home with my daughter and she had, you know, had these regressions, she lost potty training skills when we first locked down, you know, how do I bolster her spirit? How do I help her feel safe and feel better? And I thought about, you know, what does Agnes do with Ezekiel? And that was something I never could have foreseen, that sort of echo into reality. I always say now that, you know, if the book isn't for you right now because it does contain a pandemic, that's okay. You know, I don't want to hard sell anyone on this book at the moment. It is a very hopeful book, and I'm so glad of that, because its main message, although it's titled Agnes at the End of the World, its main message is that the world can't end unless we let it. Agnes has thrown this curveball of this pandemic, but her hope and her faith and her sense of strength and herself and her belief in the promise of a better world gets her through it. So I hope that, you know, somewhere there are teenagers who are reading this book and feeling like, okay, there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is an end to everything that's terrifying. And we can work to get towards that place.
This is a much more terrifying pandemic, albeit the one we're in right now isn't terribly comforting. But take us through the details of this, because there are so many details that you describe, like what happens. It's not just people who are infected, of course, any living creature, so animals as well, and then how they nest and what happens to them and how people actually, or creatures, get infected. Take us through that and how you came up with that concept.
Yes. So I think in some ways this book was more inspired by the kind of zombie apocalypse stories than by the pandemic, classic pandemic fiction. So it's not a respiratory illness like we see now. It doesn't spread through the air. It spreads by touch. And what happens if you come in contact with an infected creature is that your skin will turn kind of red and gemstone hard. And then you'll be compelled to seek out other creatures like you. So animals will seek out other animals. People will seek out other people. And they form these kind of grotesque nests. They come together, they huddle together, and they freeze in place. And that was just an image that frightened me and that I felt was strange and that I'd never seen before and was kind of Lovecraftian in a way. I've always loved the horror genre, so this is a scary book. But I was really also trying to stretch for a metaphor. I was writing about cults, and so I was very concerned with what are the positive ways that humans relate to each other? And then what are the negative ways? And this sense of these creatures and people freezing together, being unable to change course, being unable to think and be flexible. It just struck me as sort of the perfect metaphor for what cult activity really is. These people freeze into their ideologies and they're not able to escape.
It reminded me, in the weird way, of the Borg in Star Trek The Next Generation, you know, where, because they're all in this thing together, but, you know, but so then, which is a true horror image for me personally, like when I think of the Borg, like what could be worse, right? I mean, and so it was really fascinating, and yet there is hope. So Agnes, his connection with the outside world that starts her on her journey is because of her brother Ezekiel and her having to get medicine for him. And so she starts dealing with outsiders. And I thought that was interesting, that little tiny point of contact where, and it changes so much for her, where she's kind of terrified. She's been really told how bad outsiders are. And yet when she starts having that experience, it changes her. Like anytime we're open to experiences, which again is a metaphor for all sorts of things that are going on in our world right now, whether it's the politics or, you know, pandemic, when we actually confront our fear, it turns out to be somewhat different than what we might have thought it was.
Yes. And it's so funny. My husband said the same thing about the Borg when he read the book. He was like, oh, this reminds me, he's a big Star Trek fan. And yes, I think it's terrifying too. The sort of loss of identity and loss of self and will and autonomy terrifies me as a person. And I think all of us. But yes, this book is very much focused on that idea of the cult and what it takes away from us. A major way that cults operate is through disinformation. You never get the full truth when you're in a cult, and they really want to limit your ability to access anything in the outside world. Agnes's life starts to change when this outsider boy named Danny gives her a cell phone. And suddenly she has these kind of, you know, this access to all of these other larger truths. She starts to see, you know, oh, the outside world isn't this terrible place that they told me it was. It isn't just full of, you know, demons and sinners. There's goodness here. And that sort of lights a fire in her mind that, you know, if there's goodness, is there a better world? Can the outside world be better? And the tragedy for Agnes, of course, is that by the time she escapes, that world has already started to decline because she's escaped into the world of this pandemic. And then her challenge is, how does she stay hopeful enough that there's still something better than this cult in which she was raised? How does she keep from just shutting down? And to me, that's something that I think we're all kind of working through at the moment. We've all reached a point of kind of burnout and deep grief. The year is not what we expected it to be. And how do we hang on and how do we deal with that? In the logic of the book, it's faith that gets us through. That's faith in her God is what gets Agnes through. But within the book, it sort of doesn't matter what you put faith in. And I've seen that echoed in reality too. Do you remember when we were all making sourdough bread? You know, a lot of people are focusing more on their families, on their children. People were putting up Christmas lights at all times of the year. I saw people trying to like find faith and hope in these little ways to get them through what's an incredibly difficult and just brutal time.
There were so many parallels that just jumped out at me, this idea of misinformation and the cult-like mentality, you know, a lot of parallels between our political situation right now and how people will just believe a certain narrative and it really doesn't matter what other information is presented to them.
Yes, that's been one of the most terrifying things to watch. And it really is echoed in the book. The prophet in this book decides he's going to bring everyone into this bunker. And he kind of knows, you know, everyone who was thinking about it with the right facts would know that that's just a way to get infected. But he's able to convince his followers to do it because he has this kind of universe of alternative facts. And that's been just terrifying. I mean, I still remember like the night, you know, in March when we were all sort of realizing how serious this was going to be, scrolling through my phone and wondering, you know, is everyone going to be getting the same information? Are we all going to be on the same page or are we going to be sort of splintered and fractured so that we can't come together in the way that we need to? So that is something that frightens me even now.
We're speaking today with author Kelly McWilliams about her latest novel, Agnes at the End of the World. Kelly, we always like to have authors read. Is there a passage you'd like to read for us today?
Yes, I would love to read the prologue of the book. That's the very, very beginning before the story starts, and Agnes is a little girl in this section. Once, a girl lived in a double-wide trailer on ranch land beneath a wide white sky tumbled with clouds. The prophet, a scowling crow of a man, presided over everyone and everything. When the girl wasn't praying or busy with chores, she'd spin in meadows dancing with bees and dandelions until father called her name from the porch. Agnes, back in the house. Run. In Agnes's world, secular music was forbidden, as was television, radio, and all technologies of sin. She wore homemade dresses that draped every inch of skin, though they were far too hot. At 12, boys and girls were forbidden to play together, and the prophet called the children little sinners with a sneer. Nevertheless, Agnes loved her world, loved the meadow and the rocky canyon and the hawks that screeched overhead, winging impossibly high. One day, the meadow spoke. She was dancing when the hum rose up through the bottoms of her feet and into her small little girl bones. It was like a song, an old song. She pressed her ear to the ground and listened. Rocks pulsed, stones echoed, and clouds, trees, leaves rustled with melody. The girl smiled, her heart full, because God had opened her ears. He'd scratched the earth with his fingernail and revealed a hidden world. The girl was too young to see the danger in being singled out in a land where the prophet expected his faithful to march like paper dolls, arm in arm and all the same. Perfect obedience produces perfect faith. In Sunday school, Mrs. King asked the children if they remembered to pray. "I don't need to pray," said Agnes, "because God is singing everywhere all the time." Children snickered. Their teacher swiftly crossed the room. She grabbed Agnes's arm, her face purple with anger, and stretched it across the desk. Then she slammed a Bible spine across the girl's knuckles over and over until the middle knuckle of her right hand cracked like a nut. Pain exploded up her arm. She knew better than to scream. The woman bent and poured poison into her ear. Insolent child, only the prophet hears the voice of God. Lie again and I'll show you real pain. That night, hand throbbing and swollen, the girl told herself she didn't hear the sky singing or the earth humming, that she'd never heard such lovely evil things. Never, never. Perfect obedience produces perfect faith. Agnes pretended so hard not to hear that one day she didn't. The world went silent, all songs snuffed out like a candle flame. When she returned, hesitant and barefoot, to the Beespun Meadow, she heard nothing, nothing at all.
That's author Kelly McWilliams reading from Agnes at the End of the World. You know, what you're describing there becomes sort of labelled later in the book as the prayer space that she experiences. Take us through that. It's this connection to nature that Agnes experiences. It's like a religious experience, but it really is fundamentally her connection to the natural world.
Yes. One of the things about Agnes is she's raised in this very strict, oppressive cult. But she has this kind of oceanic experience of spirituality. She's one of those people, and I have met a few in real life, who just are able to see the sort of spirituality and essence of everything. And for her, she thinks of it in terms of everything in life making a kind of beautiful sound. She really understands the uniqueness of everything that we have on this earth and on this planet. She's maybe kind of more of a Buddhist at heart, but she was born into this world that really wanted to squeeze her into this very strict idea of God as this sort of totalitarian figure. And so for her, she has to shut down her innate sense of the beauty of the world, the spirituality of the world, in order to survive the cult she's in. But she's able to get back in touch with that essence, that sort of purity of her spirit, when she's liberated, when she's free. That's when she starts to hear the sounds again. And she refers to it as the prayer space, because when she sits down to pray, she's not praying to some one specific God who sets these specific rules. She's feeling something much larger and much more universal.
In that passage you read, I was very struck by what you just talked about, but also the idea of the relationship between obedience and faith. And that comes up over and over again in the book. And she's starting in a place where perfect obedience is perfect faith. And yet, by the end of the book, she realizes maybe they're not connected at all. Can you talk about that journey and what you see out there in religions and maybe your own experience about obedience and faith and how they connect?
Yes, an interesting thing about that phrase, the FLDS used to broadcast that exact line, perfect obedience produces perfect faith, over their intercom system. They would have it playing on megaphones, they would start sermons with that phrase. But the first line of the first chapter, which follows that prologue, is Agnes's sister Beth asking her, Agnes, are you in rebellion? So Agnes is kind of caught between these ideas of like, you know, obedience is the way to be faithful. This is a person who cares deeply about doing what's spiritually right. And so at first she follows that idea that, you know, obedience is what's going to take me down that road. But she later sort of understands that sometimes faith is best cultivated through rebellion, through saying no and being more true to yourself. I'm writing, you know, for teenagers and for young adults, and so many of us, have to make the decision when we're faced with what's handed down to us through our parents, through religious systems, through political systems even, you know, what are we going to keep and what are we going to toss aside? We have to feel free enough to make decisions for ourselves that, no, this religion, this system is telling me that I am not okay as a person. Maybe I can't stay. Maybe I have to rebel against it, and maybe I have to create something new and different. So that was sort of the message that I was working towards. Young adult fiction famously doesn't contain much writing about religion, because none of us want to be seen as preaching to children. I did want to address that, because that is such an almost universal experience that children have growing up. They have to decide, you know, who am I going to be? And a lot of that is based on, you know, what am I going to reject or keep from the system that raised me? Am I going to stay obedient? Or can I find something better through a little bit of rebellion? or a lot, potentially.
I find a lot of parallels with what's happening right now with the youth activism around the climate crisis and so many young people just rejecting this world and the system of organising the world that has been handed to them because they see that it's essentially headed for destruction. I mean, that really sort of jumped out at me or was at the back of my mind when I was reading this. I think really because that prayer space, that connection that Agnes has to the natural environment.
Yeah. I mean, I think all young adult writers right now, we're all thinking about climate change, and especially anyone who's writing sort of a dystopian or future world. All of our readers are going to have to contend with that. They're going to have to contend with a world that's sort of in a decline that's not in their own of their own making. For me writing this book, you know, I'm a millennial, so I graduated into this huge recession. And I felt like the world that I had been, that I had trained for, that I had studied for and been taught to expect, you know, the bottom just fell out. That world was no longer there. And there I was waving my English degree, right? So for kids today, they have to think about even graver problems. And I'm just trying to send the message. I think many of us in the young adult fiction communities, I talk to lots of writers about this. We want to keep them hopeful. We want to keep them trying, even when they're up against what feels like insurmountable odds. Because the thing about climate change is, it's so big, you can't even wrap your mind around it. And so I wanted to give away a character who was sort of trying to wrap her mind around it successfully and was able to feel in touch with it and feel everything positive from nature while still facing great turmoil.
I wanted to ask you real quick about the beginnings of each chapter. In the first couple parts, it's little sayings from the prophet. And then later on, it moves to sayings from the Psalms. And then finally, Agnes towards the end of the book. Did you get those prophet sayings directly from FLDS at all, or did you make them up? I mean, they're all kind of little keys to some of those chapters, I thought was very interestingly done.
Oh, thank you. Yes, some of those phrases are inspired by the writings of the actual prophet from the FLDS. The idea of rebellion was one of his ideas. The idea of sort of women and children not being able to interpret the word of God, that's one of his ideas. But I did write them for this prophet as a fictional character. So they were, you know, created. And I tried to have the beginnings of each chapter reflect Agnes's mindset as I was sort of charting her liberation from this very stern cult mind control that she was suffering under. So she begins with these sayings from the prophet. That's the only world she knows. Those are the rules she knows. That's how she understands what's around her. In the second half of the book, after she's escaped, she turns to the source, what she feels might be the source of every religion, which is, you know, her, these, you know, Psalms. Like that's the ultimate source of the religion that the prophet warped. So she's looking at, okay, what's the original thing here? But then by the end, you know, it's not even Psalms anymore. Agnes is doing her own writing. She's in some ways creating her own religion. She's able to express her own ideas. So that's was just kind of a little map for readers of her journey towards freedom.
Well, we have been speaking today with Kelly McWilliams, a Colorado-based author, a young adult novelist, and her latest book is Agnes at the End of the World. There's a lot more to talk about that we're going to get into in the podcast-only edition of the Radio Book Club. So please do subscribe to the podcast, Radio Book Club. Check out the After Hours edition. Right now, though, we're going to thank Kelly for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Arsene, as we always do at the end of each episode, we announce the next book that we're inviting listeners to read along with us. So what have we got for the first month of 2021, January? What are we reading for the Radio Book Club?
We're going to read Classic Krakauer by John Krakauer, and he'll be joining us to discuss it. These are essays and pieces he wrote for magazines, mostly in the 80s and 90s. There are some newer pieces that are also included, but they cover all sorts of things. Of course, there's lots of outdoor adventure stuff, but he's a great writer, and he's so well known now for the books he's done, but he really burst onto the scene with some of these magazine pieces that were, and I think it'll be an amazing read. It's a great wintertime read because a lot of things happen in cold weather in his stuff.
Do tune in on the fourth Thursday of January 2021. You can hear John Krakauer as our guest at the Radio Book Club. But don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast, listen anytime, and of course, catch the bonus content after hours at the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host is Arsene Keshkashian. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.
And that's the Radio Book Club. So nice to hear Maeve's voice. She was our beloved news director and moved on, and she still does the Radio Book Club and a few other things. And it sounded like an interesting book. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. This is the Morning Sound Alternative Christmas Eve. Happy Christmas Eve to you. I know a lot of us are heavy-hearted. It's been, let's face it, a brutal year. And it's been grief-laced, any way you look at it. There's just an underpinning of grief. So I wanted to start off with some gentle, soothing music. This is a song I discovered a long time ago and put on a Christmas mix that I made for friends. And this song is quite impossible to find. So I hope you enjoy it. Miriam is another name for Mary. Cliff Eberhardt here on the Morning Sound Alternative.
No banners were unfurled when God stepped into the world, held in the arms of a little girl named Miriam. Who would ever believe fiancé, your family, the teenage pregnancy of Miriam. But laws of nature were suspended, death sentences rescinded throughout all the world, all because of a little girl named Miriam. Medieval paintings glaring down, stony figures judge and frown, and wearing a halo like a crown, could that be Miriam? In Gentile temples stained